Well, if you type into Google, what was it? How do you get to the Shire to Mordor?
Oh, yeah, you used to be able to. You could put into Google Maps your start location Shire, and the Shire, your end location Mordor. And it, and the result that comes back is one does not simply walk into Mordor. You have to pick the footpath, too, by foot. But they disabled it. It doesn't work anymore.
Well, we're all here, so why don't we do a podcast?
Okay. Ready?
Ready.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Return to sender. Welcome to Stamp Show here today. I'm sitting here with Scott, Kaz, Tom, Jeff, and Brian, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. You can also send us an email at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. So let's talk about stamps. We're going to talk about This Week in History, U.S. Postal Carriers, updates, which is going to turn to more of a topical discussion. Hashtag Stamp Stories, Jerry Buss. Experts' topic this week is faults. This Week in History. On October 31st, 1868, a very ironic date, a standard uniform was approved for the U.S. postal carriers. Postmaster General Alexander W. Randall issued an order describing the postal uniform to be invariably worn by letter carriers while on duty, end quote. During the Civil War, U.S. Postal Services began free delivery in 49 of the American cities. Before that, people had to either pick up their mail at the post office or pay for home delivery. Letter carriers began wearing uniforms, blue, gray, sack, coats, pants, and a hat. You can find more information at pbs.org and postaluniformsblog.com. So this is the first thing I heard that mail wasn't always delivered to your door.
Wait a minute. They have a blog about postal uniforms?
Someone really likes them.
How much can you say about postal uniforms?
And the irony is October 31st is Halloween for those people who didn't catch that on. I can't see a whole lot of discussion on postal uniforms either.
Do you think governments know irony? Do you think the government understands irony?
About, do you think they care?
Halloween and uniforms being issued? Or
well, there was that recent CIA Twitter thing that was going around where their very first post, they made a joke, and there's been a lot of controversy whether that was, you know, a good idea or a bad idea for the CIA to start joking around on their Twitter account.
What was their joke?
I forget. Something to do with spying on the American people or something like that. I forget.
Yeah, that would be in
poor taste. It was very funny.
Yeah.
Sounds like they're just coming out with something that they didn't want you to know.
But Brian brought up something. I wonder if the blue and gray sack coats were because of the North and South.
Well, you know, blue and gray are very... those are the colors of the North and the South. I was wondering if they ran out of blue, or they decided that they would just take the two pigments and mix them together, or if there was any kind of reason that they did that.
You know, I just thought of something. Maybe those are the coats that they ground up to make the bluish paper experiments in the Washington Franklin.
Ah. Yeah, but that was almost 50 years later. There.
Well, they were worn out.
Oh, recycling. Oh, that makes so much sense.
They were
now.
Recycling.
Yeah, okay.
Blue gray could have been like a neutral color. It was neither blue nor gray.
I'm kind of curious why they call them sack coats.
Sack refers to the it's the type of cloth that's used. It's a very inferior
similar,
kind of
similar to burlap.
Yeah, oh. Yeah. It's a rough cloth that was very
so it's not
very,
a design. It's what it's made out of.
Yeah, I think yeah. Most military uniforms were made out of sack. Civil War uniforms would have been made out of sackcloth. It's kind of a recycled cloth, I want to say.
Burlap
very,
coats.
Very cheap.
That yes, had, yeah, absolutely.
That had to be excitingly uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so this week on updates, we're not really doing updates. We're going to start a discussion on...
Well, hold on. I have an update.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
There was a Hello Kitty museum exhibit at the American Japanese Cultural Exhibit on our way into the Sescal Stamp Show. We're driving down Century Boulevard, and the banners are all up advertising Hello Kitty. And there's somebody here at the desk, I forget who it is, somebody here collects Hello Kitty stamps. And I think it might be Brian.
Was it Cash just outed Brian?
How did you know?
It was very comforting to be surrounded by at the show.
Let's just say the person in question has a Hello Kitty coffee maker, a Hello Kitty toaster, a Hello Kitty TV, a Hello Kitty steering wheel cover. I can keep going.
And Hello Kitty stamps from the last stamp show.
Yes.
Yes, at a good price.
Stamps make it cool.
No, they don't.
But you just keep thinking that.
Okay, so our question is expertizing, and who is going to be the new generation of expertizers? The question was brought up in an article called Who is Studying at the Expertizer's Knee by Charles Snee, who's the editor of Lens. And the article kind of states a couple of bullet points. They say the numbers are dwindling. Do you guys concur?
No, I don't.
I think so.
I think the number of specialists might be dwindling because more people are getting back into generic collecting. But I think there's probably just as many experts out there as there always has been.
I think the collectors aren't taking it to the level that many of the old-time collectors and dealers did take it to. And I think that it may be what he's talking about.
Well, there's no payoff anymore because there aren't the issues like there were in the 1950s that you can do great discoveries on. You know, obviously it's a decreasing, it's diminishing returns. The amount of philatelic knowledge decreases as time goes by unless you add new stamps in. And the new stamps that are added in are not ones that line themselves up for expertization. Nobody's going to specialize on the 3-cent chicken industry stamp, although somebody should.
Or Zambonis,
yeah. And I think that's really the only reason why somebody would say that the experts are dwindling is they don't have there's not the philatelic research going on now like it used to.
Well, but I think all of the expert committees that issue certificates are having trouble finding people to replace the older collectors or the older experts who have been doing this for many, many years, would like to pass on that knowledge, but there just isn't a new generation waiting in the wings to kind of learn all that stuff at this time. And I know I'm always looking for somebody to share my knowledge with.
Well, hey, we're lucky. I think the average age in this room is, what, about 40? So we're not doing too bad.
Is it that high?
Yeah, it's around there. Maybe mid-40s.
I think all of us are. Jessica and I are on the lower end. Yeah. Scott and Kaz are on the upper end. And Tom and Brian are in the middle.
Yeah.
Ma'am.
So about 40.
No, I would love to see some sort of expertizing topic coming in where material is available that people could start specializing in like they did with the 3-cent 1851 issue and the 1-cent 1851 issue and the U.S. number ones.
I think another problem is that the more modern stamps, there's a lot with all the computer design and the printing and all of that, there's a lot fewer varieties to go chase after and learn about than there were 100 years ago.
Well, I think one of the, and we see this all the time, the experts that are, let's say, rising up are ones that are using technology to discover new things. Like I'm going to make him angry because I don't remember his name, the person who did the fantastic write-up on the extra perforation rows in the revenue stamps. And he had fantastic research done with computers and modeling and everything like that. And I think that's what's going to happen in the future, you know, putting stamps under UV light, discovering different characteristics of color, things like that. I think that's a new one. I don't think it's plating
the chicken stamp.
The chicken stamp. Yeah, I don't think plating the chicken stamp is going to draw a lot of new experts to the hobby, but I think that using computers on this stuff will.
Actually, I think all of the recent innovation where you've seen really exciting things in the area of expertizing, all of it has been done by the younger generation coming in. I could cite several examples, but I don't think I really need to. But, you know, with computers, with even the introduction of the VSCs, I believe almost all the expertizing companies have VSCs now. Grading, that was all done by the younger crowd. And they're really changing the face of expertizing. It's rather exciting.
Well, the newest VSC is computer-based, isn't it?
Yes.
It doesn't have its own separate screen anymore, so.
Well, I think, and I've said this before, give it 10 years and you won't have VSCs anymore. You'll have specific cameras that just will plug directly into your computer.
By the way, for the sake of people who don't quite realize what a VSC is, could you explain really quickly what a VSC is?
VSC stands for Video Spectral Comparator, and it allows you to use different wavelengths of light and different exposures and camera angles to examine an item, and it allows you to compare that with a control under certain circumstances, and allows you to see under different conditions very specific things. And generally we use it for sometimes seeing removed cancels, different colors, hard to see things that are hard to see with it, with
watermarks,
yeah. With the, you know, things that you can't see with other technologies or other techniques, a lot of times will be brought out under these very unique and controllable conditions.
I think the best description of it is what they use for autographs. Now everybody has VSCs when they look at autographs, and you can tell where the hesitation marks are from where people signed, mm-hmm. the different types of ink that are used, when they lifted the pen up, when they put it down. So it gets very, very specific into autographs. How it relates to stamp collecting is exactly like you said. You can see cancels being removed, cancels being changed, colors being changed. You can obviously see different textures in the paper where there's thins or tears or creases. But one thing to note is that they are incredibly expensive.
At this time, yes.
At this time. A cheap one is going to run you $50,000, and a top-of-the-line one will cost you $250,000. So this isn't something that the stamp collectors out there are going to run to the store and get real quick because they heard it on a podcast.
They're not on eBay. I looked. My favorite is, I have a whole file that I'm collecting of stuff found in the VSC and under microscopes, is repairs where people have added paper to stamps.
Mm-hmm.
They'll show up really well.
So he mentioned that there are pitfalls when you get a great deal and there's no cert, but that dealers will sometimes refund you if you get a cert saying, wow, this stamp has this, and this done to it.
Well, any honest dealer will do that. There are many reasons why a dealer wouldn't do that, and most of them are not good reasons.
Well, isn't there an old saying that if it's too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you...
Brian, you're a dealer.
Yeah.
What do you do?
It depends on where I'm selling it and how long it's been. If somebody's held on to the stamp for 5 years and they bought it off of eBay and there's no way for me to verify it, they're kind of on their own. But if they bought it from me and I have records of it, if there's a way I could look it up, absolutely, I'll do a refund as far out as I can.
They also mentioned that their high dollar was $200. Anything above $200, you need a cert, which varies, I guess. It's all relative. Because I guess Kaz earlier said $300.
Yeah. Well, at some point, you kind of self-insure. You know, if you got a 7 or 8 figure bank account, you know, $300 is not a whole lot. You don't want to keep blowing it, but at the same time, one item isn't going to kill you.
I kind of disagree. $300 is a lot of money to just about everybody.
Well, yeah, but not everybody has the same ability to absorb something like that. And you don't want to keep doing it, obviously.
Well, the reason I always pick $300, and who put down the $200? This was Charles Snee.
It was in the article,
yeah. Yeah, it was in the article. I said $300 because a certificate generally costs $30. And I figure 10% is a nice round number. If you want to go down to $200, I totally understand where Mr. Snee got the number from. But it really is just where you draw the line. I will tell you, though, that we have seen many stamps where people have paid thousands of dollars and the stamps were repaired, rebacked, regummed. Clearly, if you're going to spend any significant money, you either need the cert or you need to know what you're doing, because the horror story that I have is a person who paid $5,700 for number 67, I believe it was. And it was mint hinged, and it turned out it was rebacked, cancel, remove, regum, total fake stamp, totally faked. And it was worth, you know, $100 as a space filler, maybe $50. And the person paid $5,700 for it. It was clearly outside of his comfort zone. He should have had a cert.
Was that recent? I'm trying to remember if that's one that...
That was about a year and a half ago.
Okay. There was one not too long ago somebody paid a lot of money for it that came back through. Not very good. I was curious, the same one.
Well, I think one of the problems is I think collectors need to be a little bit more vigilant about this. If there's something that they're paying a significant amount of money for, they should send it in for a cert within a reasonable amount of time. Not all dealers are as reasonable as I am. If they're holding on to something and you just don't know if that person bought it from you or not, you can't give them a refund. And if you're waiting 5 years, the records are probably going to be gone, and it's unreasonable to expect to get a refund. But if you know, you send it in within a couple months, you both clearly have records of it, absolutely. I think more dealers, more often than not, would absolutely give a refund, and more times than not, will probably pay for the cert.
I think that from all the dealers that I have met face-to-face, I cannot think of a single one who would not refund.
Right.
Etiquette would say that you should do it with no more than 60 to 90 days.
Yes.
But realistically, you buy a stamp, you're kind of emotionally invested in it at that point. You want to spend a little time with your baby before you have to send it off for a couple of weeks to have it certified. So that's understandable, and then you get busy and you forget about it. But you should, in any case, you should do it within the first 6 months of owning a stamp.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, I want to make sure it's my baby and not somebody else's baby.
Right.
So we basically established that there's a need for experts. So if you're interested in learning more about expertizing, there's a couple of places. There's the FFEjournal.com. They have a journal that's fakes, forgeries, and I think it's ephemera, and they have different ways of telling, different examples, just a really good, strong, I think, quarterly journal that comes out with the newest, latest, and greatest doctored stamps around the world. Another one is stamps.org. The APS has a summer seminar where they teach you about different aspects of collecting, and there are different workshops tailored to people's interests. And that runs, this year is going to run June 21st to 26th. Oh, next year, sorry. They've already finished the registration for this year. And there's also stamp community forums. There's a lot of knowledgeable people that go there and just kind of filter ideas past each other.
I just want to add, there's other places where that are doing seminars now. Last week we touched upon stamp shows starting to do seminars. And I kind of feel like this is becoming more and more of a trend. As I don't know if these two topics are related, but I think that the general population is very interested in learning about expertizing through these seminars. And
I agree. I totally agree. At Tescal, Scott had a seminar that was very good, and the feedback was basically, please do this for the rest of your life. There's clearly, it went over very well, and clearly people like it. And it's not, you know, he didn't go over, because I sat in on the seminar, he didn't go over, this is how you tell if this Perf 10 stamp is, you know, this variety versus this variety. It was very general stuff. It's look out for reperfs, and here's a couple ways to detect them. Look out for regums. Here's a couple ways to protect it. Dip your stamps in lighter fluid and double check them. I mean, it takes very little time. You dip it and you go, hey, what's that? Well, it must be something. So I think I'm not going to buy this stamp. You know, it's just a little knowledge goes a really, really long way. I mean, we're not having people expertise, you know, flat plate coils. But you should be able to tell whether your Mint Never Hinge 2-cent Colombian is actually a Mint Never Hinge 2-cent Colombian. I mean, if you want to add something, because you were obviously up there talking.
Well, I'll tell you, at least as far as is it never hinged or not, that is a can of worms. At a stamp show, a lot of times the lighting's not optimal. And
I'd say it's a little worse than not optimal. I'd say it's some of the worst light I've ever seen.
I was being nice.
Yeah.
Ballroom.
But you have to have good light to be able to be sure that your stamp is never hinged. And you do the best that you can at the show. And just as with certification, you should be able to return a stamp that's not as described. And so always check your stamps after you get home so that you can return them the next time you see the dealer if you need to.
So this week's stamp stories I'm really excited about because something I can talk to my dad about because he loves the Lakers. Dr. Jerry Buss's estate stamp collection is coming up for sale on November 14th. And his stamp story is that while being the owner of Los Angeles Lakers, he was a prominent collector of stamps and coins. He worked at the age of 13 digging ditches in the cold and a bellhop and running a mail order stamp collecting business at 13. And what were you guys doing at 13? I wasn't doing three jobs.
I was digging ditches, but it wasn't cold.
There we go.
Was it uphill both ways?
Yeah.
No wonder he ended up being able to own the Lakers later on. That's a businessman. Three jobs at the age of 13. Good grief.
Yeah.
On November 12, 1986, Buss sold a 1867 U.S. postage stamp known as the 1-cent Z Grill, otherwise known as an 85A. There are only two known to exist, and they are coveted by philatelists worldwide. His sale brought $380,000, the second highest price ever paid for a single stamp at the time. Buss bought the Z Grill stamp through Superior Stamp and Coin in 1977 for $90,000. He sold his coin collection in 1985 through Superior for $3.64 million and used Superior again to sell his stamp collection. Buss said through a spokesperson that at the time he didn't have time to maintain a stamp collection, adding, "It belongs in the hands of an active collector." So do you guys know anything about, let's see.
I'm just a little curious if he would have held on to his stamp for another 30 years, if he would have known that it, just 30 years later, it would have brought five times that money. That's a pretty good return.
Yeah. Well, he's a good businessman, obviously. Yeah.
Well, not so good if he leaves about $1.6 million on the table.
Well, Kaz, you're an economist. Going from the 80s, what, how, accounting for inflation, how much do you think you kind of missed out on?
Well, going from the 70s, basically you add a zero to things.
Okay.
Yeah, but he sold it in 1986. There was a recession in the 90s. They had the recession in the late 90s, early 2000s.
I think it was, I wonder, and this is only referring back because of the 1 cent magenta, I wonder if he put an expertizing mark on the back. Because, you know, the expertizing, the graffiti on the back of the stamp. You know,
actually, the 1 cent Z-grill, I've examined it myself. It's actually surprisingly clean on the back.
Oh.
I think there's only maybe one or two expertising marks, or if that.
I haven't seen the back of it, so I don't know. I've seen the front of it, obviously.
I haven't seen it in about over 5 years. Yeah. I couldn't tell you.
But it definitely does not look like a subway wall in South Central. It's not covered in graffiti.
Like the back of the 1 cent. No, actually, it looks very clean.
Yeah, Jessica, you mentioned, did you ever see the picture of the back of the 1 cent magenta?
No, I haven't.
With all the expertising marks, though. That's an interesting looking back of the stamp.
Now it's in a glass fortress.
Yeah.
So, no more marks on that stamp.
Oh, no, I'll bet you the next owner puts a mark on it. I would if I were them.
Do you think owners have been scribbling their name on the back?
Or oh, bet you. That one, you look at the back. It has. It's got, what, 8 or 10 expert marks?
And there's at least another 6 or 8 marks on there that aren't expert marks.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would say that quite a few of the owners have put their mark on that stamp.
Bill Gross was here.
Yeah.
He's never owned it.
Yeah, he's never owned that stamp.
Well, for example.
But on the back of the...
We also don't know who the new owner is.
Exactly. That's why he's kind of inserted a name.
On the back of the 85A, that is rumored to be in black Sharpie. That's rumored to be inscribed on the back of that stamp.
So his collection going for auction. It's your last chance to own a piece of the bus history. It's going to be Canada, Newfoundland, and some early ones. They have a Scott C1 Newfoundland with original gum and a Newfoundland C5. And a lot of these have certificates of authenticity.
Good.
PF did a couple. PSE did most of them.
Oh, better. Raw team.
Yay. And there's some pretty high dollar
stamps.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of... I want to say the overprint thing.
The word is stamps. You're right, Tom.
Well, that gap will disappear.
There we go.
Will the banter in between the gap also disappear?
Banter is also going to disappear.
That's a shame, because that's the best part of the...
Banter comes and goes.
I might edit the 7 seconds of silence down to 2.
There we go.
Will you include the banter?
I'll try.
No, please don't.
It's in for sure now.
So if you're looking for some rare stamps with some interesting provenance, you can go to stampcircuit.com. That's where all the auction information you can find is at. So this week's expert topic is a mouthful. We're just going to cover a few regarding faults. So who wants to start us off with faults?
What's a fault?
Oh, good call.
What's a fault, Cash?
Fault is anything that happens to a piece of paper that wasn't intended to be on the paper.
What's a fault, Brian?
Actually, that's a pretty good definition. I'd say anything that happened after the production of the stamp that makes it a little less, lessens the eye appeal of the stamp.
Yeah.
What's a fault, Tom?
I agree and disagree at the same time, because there are many things that can be considered a fault that happened during the manufacture process. Paper True. Inclusions, things like that.
Production flaws.
Gum faults.
No, but those are production flaws, not faults.
Potato, potato. Well,
they all add up to the same thing when they take away a grade on your stamp.
That's true.
Potato, I don't care where it came potato, from, potato, if it made my 95 point. And 85.
Mm-hmm.
Tomato, tomato.
Let's call the whole thing off.
I thought faults were basically a mishandling of the stamp after it was born.
There you go. I like that one.
Back to the baby analogy.
Yeah, because it's your baby.
Well, the list here has tears, creases, thins, pulled perfs, stains, toned spots, facial scuffs. That's pretty much it because, you know, getting hit by truck, tire marks, whatever. You know, it's all makes the stamp ugly. I mean, some faults may be very small. I mean, well, that's one thing to bring up is that realistically every stamp has faults. Well, it's just where you draw the line.
If you get a big enough magnifier, yeah, you can find faults on anything.
I mean, it was organic paper is going to have little specks of inclusion in it. When you pull the stamp apart at the perforations, one perf might be slightly smaller than another perf. You know, so you could consider these flaws, but, you know, you have to draw the line someplace and say, this is where we draw the line at where we recognize faults.
So how big does a tear have to be for it to be mentioned?
Well, under the PSE grading system, there's various levels of tears. The tiny tear, the small tear. The tiny tear is around half a millimeter, and a small tear is about 1 millimeter, and then anything more than about 2 millimeters is just a tear. It is kind of it's very specific, but it's also very small, and most people don't want tears on their stamp anyway. Mm-hmm. So it necessarily small, and that's how it affects the grade.
I think a tear, if you have a tear on a perf tip, it's a world of difference than if you have a tear at the bottom of the perf hole where it goes into the design. They could both be the same distance or the same size. But, you know, there's a certain amount of forgiveness when people are tearing their stamps apart that doesn't exist if it goes into the design of the stamp.
And that's just a measure of severity. I mean, if you have a torn perf with the piece of the perf hanging there, that's still a fault, and it still needs to be called something, and it needs to reduce the grade in some fashion. But in relation to a tear that goes halfway across the stamp, then that's a severity issue, not a is it there or not issue.
So when do you guys call a crease a problem?
Well, actually,
because I thought all creases
are I was going to ask Brian, because you deal with stamps much more than anybody else at the table. I mean, you are a stamp dealer. Where do you see the price of a stamp change from, let's say, a small tear or something like that? Or would you mention it at all? Or would you?
Oh, absolutely. Even a tiny tear, half a millimeter, that definitely affects the value. It's just like Scott said, as the tear becomes more severe, it affects the value more and more.
By how much? I mean, do you have any idea?
If it gets above a millimeter, you're looking at about half the price for a comparable stamp with the same centering. If you're getting a tear halfway across the stamp,
a
substantial discount.
Well, it's all relative because I know I looked at a stamp that was torn in half and reattached, and it still brought 70% of catalog value.
Well,
but that was because it's a rare stamp.
What stamp was it?
It was actually a rare trial color proof.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but some items, you throw Scott catalog out the window.
Yeah.
Especially items where the population is incredibly low.
Right. Trial color proof, they're probably only a handful, literally a handful, less than five in existence. And this was one of them. And the catalog value still said it was $8,000 or $9,000. And it brought a very high percentage of that because it was truly rare.
Well, the 1 cent magenta is thinned, torn, repaired, recolorized, part of the image is drawn back in again, and it got $9.5 million.
Hello.
How about creases? Well, actually, look at the list here. From a standpoint of selling a stamp, which ones like just destroy the value, and which ones are like they hurt the value but not so much?
All the faults you mentioned, they substantially hurt the value. It just depends on the degree that they hurt the value.
Now, one thing I wanted to bring up on the list that was read off, we have thins, we also have facial scrapes, which are also called scuffs. And I wanted to bring up the difference between those two. A thin is generally paper that's come off of fibers that have come off the back of the stamp, either from being improperly removed from an envelope or having a improper hinge removal or some other method on the back of the stamp. A facial scrape or a scuff is basically the same mechanical thing on the front of the stamp. It's generally caused by abrasions or something like that rather than like hinge removal, but they're basically mechanically that they do the same thing. They thin the paper just on one side of the stamp or the other.
Except the obviously a facial scrape
is generally visual as well as thinning the paper, because a lot of times it will take away part of the design.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you touched upon something very important. Faults that you see, if you have it mounted in your album and you can see the fault, then that substantially hurts the value of the stamp. If it's something on the back where you can kind of hide it in your album, people tend to be a little more forgiving, and they may pay a little bit more for that type of stamp.
Well, and that I think is a big thing that drives people who collect hinged stamps versus never hinged stamps. You put it in your album and you're not looking at the gum, you're looking at the front of the stamp. So once it's in there, you know, but anybody else looking at the album is not going to know.
Yeah, but sometimes you just can't afford a beautiful NH stamp. Your budget just doesn't allow it. So
right.
You still want to put something in your album. So
right.
Sometimes you put fakes in your album just to fill the spot.
No, I don't.
Oh. I was at a show and I saw a plate block of four, and there were six hinges on the back of it. And I'm going, at what point are the hinges just holding the block together, and at what point are they used to put in the album?
On some Perf 12 stamps, many of them are being held together by hinges.
That absolutely. Perf
12 stamps, they'll fall apart if you breathe on a bunny.
Absolutely, that is something that was done. As a matter of fact, the Weil brothers from New Orleans, they had little strips of hinge that they would reinforce perforations on multiples that had weak perforations. And I see them all the time. They're specifically cut, and they're little tiny. They're very tiny, and they cover basically just about the width of the perforations. Mm-hmm. And they're very specific and very tiny. And when you break up that multiple and that little piece of hinge is not there anymore, the stamp is still hinged. Once you've disturbed the gum, it's still hinged. And it can very easily be missed, especially at a show when the lighting is not good.
One thing to point out to people, too, is when you do have these plate blocks, if you don't see hinges reinforcing the perfs, still dip the stamp, because one of the other tricks is you get Ducco cement and you touch the perfs with a little dot of Ducco cement and it strengthens it. It adds a little more bulk to it. But when you dip it, you'll see that the watermark fluid does not go into the perfs at all.
Yeah, it almost has a white texture to it.
Yeah. But it preserves the plate block. It may, you know, without it, you wouldn't have plate blocks anymore. I mean, they'd just fall apart. I mean, I see that with 3-cent plate blocks, you know. A lot of times they'll be maybe not poorly stored, but, you know, average storage. And they'll break apart, especially,
Well, that's because the paper gets brittle.
Yeah, but I'll bet you in 50 years there is no more Army Navy plate blocks. I mean, they're just so brittle. They fall apart so easily that if they're not reinforced, you're not going to have plate blocks.
So the reinforcement caused different kind of toning because parts of the paper are being aged differently with the fluid or whatever
on
them?
It can, yes.
I'm sure they're not archival safe glues they're using.
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah, how old is that glue? I've never heard of that before. Is it still Ducco? Available?
It's
like an art glue.
Yeah, but okay. It's a very, very strong glue. It's like, I want to say it's almost like crazy glue. It's
like super glue, strong. Kind of?
What I would compare it to is like model glue, like plastic model glue.
Yeah, that's probably more correct.
Is there a proper way to sore stamps so that they don't get these creases and tears and glue and...
Well, you mean
under your mattress is not a good place.
Yeah. Or in your shoe.
Your wallet.
I think the number one way to store them if you have difficult ones is people always put them in the show guard mount and they mount them on a page and the page bends back and forth because it's a page. And what some of these really need is they need a hard backing. You need to put them in an actual like sleeve where it doesn't bend because just the motion of bending it back and forth. I mean, you know, Brian, when I mentioned the Army Navies, he gave me sort of a funny look.
Well, because I don't believe you for a second. They'll be around for the rest of my life.
you know what I mean, though. It is a notoriously bad plate block.
They're going to exist. All you have to do is keep them in some glassines for a few years. And if nobody touches them, they'll be just fine.
Okay, how about this? If they're inside of stamp albums, they'll go away. If they're not in stamp albums, they'll be fine. But no, the whole thing is that when people put them in, and I take them out of stamp collections all the time because, you know, you kind of get them in postage lots. And you pull them out, and half of them are separated. They've got perf separations all over them. And,
well, one thing I want to mention about, you talk about long-term storage. The very important thing to keep in mind is what medium you're storing the stamps on, because... Various, especially plastics, they have a certain plasticizer in there that is meant to keep the plastic clear and keep it from breaking down. That disintegrates after about 10 years. That's the life of the plasticizers. And one thing that they have, the main chemical in that is sulfur. Well, when sulfur breaks down, you know, it becomes sulfur dioxide. Is that what... Sulfuric acid, yeah. Sulfuric acid is an amazing thing, and it destroys stamps rather quickly. And we are seeing a ton of stamps that are changing because of sulfuric acid. And it's just, you see a lot of toning that's caused by that. You see the paper becoming more and more brittle. That's caused by that. And this is just from improper storage. If you keep your stamps on acid-free paper, not in mounts, probably glassines as well, then you have a better chance of storing it for another 50, 100 years, however long.
My favorite story about that is I bought a stamp collection, and it was a mint collection in a old H.E. Harris album. Mm-hmm. And the person had, instead of using stamp hinges, they used actual tape. They taped the stamps in.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And the acid inside of the tape migrated into the stamp.
Yes.
The stamp became so brittle that it literally shattered. I don't mean it broke into pieces when it was bent. It became so brittle. It was amazing. I had never seen anything like it before.
Well, you see the same thing happening in old scrapbooks where people have taped the corners of their photographs to the edges. And at first, it just browns the paper. But after a while, that paper becomes so brittle that it just cracks. And that's the same thing that we see all the time with stamps nowadays.
Yep. There's no way to restore them once they're acidified that highly with tape. You that's one of the faults that you have with toning spots. I'll bet you 95% of the toning spots are from some sort of sulfur somewhere in the paper or in the book or in the hinges or something like that, just making these grayish yellow blotches on the stamp.
Toning or foxing is a little bit different.
Foxing is different.
That's an organic process.
Yeah, yeah, that's an organic process caused by bacteria actually eating away the stamp. They both produce very similar results, though.
What does foxing look like?
It's brown spots.
Brown circular spots. It looks like a little petri dish of
When you go to an old book in a library and you open it up and you see the little brown specks all over the page, that's foxing, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of old documents and you see it and you fight it all the time.
Yeah, but that could be cured. I know this is kind of a lot of people say, oh, this is a terrible idea, but that could be cured with a very, very dilute solution of bleach. It would kill off all the bacteria. Mm-hmm. They use similar chemicals. There's some other chemicals that actually freeze and kill the bacteria. If you can kill the bacteria, then you can start working on repairing that. But
well, if it's not a mint stamp...
Just so we're clear, don't bleach your stamps.
Yeah.
No. This is
if you don't know how much bleach to use, don't use any.
No, I'm talking about incredibly dilute.
And very, very small amounts.
On certain documents.
I'll also put hydrogen peroxide solution.
But I don't know if hydrogen peroxide actually kills the bacteria.
No, it doesn't. But what it will do is it will restore it. It restores an oxygen molecule to the sulfur, breaking it into sulfur and oxygen, which
is a gas.
I forget what the chemistry of it is, but any oxidation will be partially reversed if you mix hydrogen peroxide with it.
Yeah, because what happens chemically is the oxygen and the sulfur occur on the same place on the periodic table. And what you're doing is you're just simply replacing them, and then the sulfur just sort of evaporates into the air.
Right. I'm not sure whether you add or take away an oxygen molecule. But
you're substituting a sulfur molecule with an oxygen molecule.
Right. And we use it with U.S. number 11s. You know, you have horrible oxidation, which turns red stamps brown.
Yeah, but you got to be careful with you got to be really careful with hydrogen peroxide because it will change the color of the paper, change the color of the ink pigments, especially some of these more fugitive ink pigments. And as it's being used over time, it does the same thing that the sulfuric acid does. It'll eat away the stamp.
We're not talking about soaking it in pure H2O2.
Yeah,
this is 2%. That's then diluted on top of that.
Down I was going to say 2% is way too strong.
When I soak, I'll use a whole bowl of water, and I'll put a third of a cap full of bleach, maybe tops, and maybe a half of a cap full of hydrogen peroxide in it, and that's a nice little mix for cleaning up whatever is ailing the stamps because there's a lot of biological stuff going on. And you want to remove it. It also assists a bit in getting rid of the gum because a lot of times the gums need a little bit of bleach to remove them also. Some of the gums back then were animal gums, and they're very hard to scrape off the paper unless you put a little bit of an agent that gets in there,
Yeah, maybe the guy who stuck the stamp to the letter had Ebola.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
And that's why I no longer collect stamps from Africa.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So I hope you learn a lot about how to prevent these faults and what they look like. We're going to keep talking about this in a future episode. Email us at stampshareheretoday@gmail.com with your questions or comments and keep the conversation going online on Twitter and Facebook. And, as always, keep collecting.
I'm Brian Metz with OCStampStore.com with your stamp tip of the week. When you're looking at your 1922 through 31 4th Bureau definitive sets, you can quickly identify your flat plate versus rotary press stamps by looking at the gum. If the gum is uniform and flat, then it's flat plate. If it has horizontal gum breaker ridges, then it's rotary, with the exception of coil waste issues, which are rotary but still have flat gum. For more U.S. stamp tips, sign up for my newsletter at OCStampStore.com.
Hi, this is Tom Mills, H.R. Harmer Stamp Auctions. You're listening to the podcast for Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurse, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today. No such person. No such soul.